You're tuned to WFHB
91.3
and 98.1 FM.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community.
And supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM, reporting live for WFHB. This is Carolyn Vanderweel.
And I'm Ryan Stacey. This is the Daily Local News for Thursday, July 21st, 2016.
They're deliberately selling it here for less than what it costs to make, with the intention of gaining market share.
Steelworkers in Indiana are at the center of a trade dispute with China that could change the shape of a century-old state industry. That story is coming up later in the show in today's WFHB Community Report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, our weekly public opinion feature Voices in the Street asks what Bloomington thinks of Vice Presidential hopeful Mike Pence. But first, these local headlines.
Monroe County lost out on federal grant money that would have funded road construction in the Westside Economic Development Area, or WEDA. County Public Works Director Lisa Ridge told the Monroe County Redevelopment Commission last night that the county was one of more than 200 applicants hoping for a piece of the $800 million Fastlane grant funding. The county wanted to use the Fastlane grant money to extend Profile Parkway and Industrial Drive, providing better access to I-69. County Attorney Jeff Cockerell described the project.
What I think we're talking about now is the Profile Parkway Industrial Drive aspect of that, and that's the road that would go over the railroad tracks by Coles, hook up to Gates Drive, and then have a roadway go across the old ABB site, as well as, and off that road would be a road that goes down to Jonathan Drive.
Without the grant, Ridge said the commission now needs to consider separating each road into its own project and prioritizing those projects.
The connectivity is the main issue in this, so I would just suggest you keep in mind the Industrial Park Drive portion of, if we break it into two projects, that would be your main concern of the vehicles coming off Vernal Pike versus going down to Curry Pike. So if we were to prioritize between Profile Parkway and Industrial Park Drive on a traffic standpoint, Industrial Park Drive would outweigh the Profile Parkway extension.
Commission member Don Moore sparked a discussion about whether further road infrastructure is needed. Moore said he didn't want to see the county fall into a, quote, build it and they will come scenario, unquote, and questioned whether projects were being chosen based on hopes for the future instead of economics.
I'm seeing a county that isn't growing that much population-wise. What are we, about 1% per year, some net like that? Mm-hmm. I think that's a net. The net might even be lower, I'm not sure. But somewhere around there, I'm not seeing much beyond replacement of business operations, more so than new business operations. Maybe you could speak to that for me. And, you know, do we really, in this part of the world, at this particular time in our nation's history, are we really going to be foreseeing the need for infrastructural build-out based upon economic, foreseeable economic benefits? I mean, we can always say build it and there'll be a benefit, maybe, but, you know, a lot of ghost towns have been made on that same assumption.
Eakin and others responded in favor of the road extensions. Eakin said adding infrastructure in the WEDA is important for retaining existing Westside businesses. Ridge said the county could also reapply for a Fastlane grant in spring of 2017.
In its meeting Tuesday night, the Monroe County Plan Commission gave final approval for the Holland Fields housing development planned for 790 East Holland Drive, just off of South Walnut Street Pike. Engineer Steve Brehub represented the developers' hybrid development group at the meeting. Brehub said the proposed housing development is a perfect fit for the site because it meets the county's vision of growth as described in the county's 2012 Comprehensive Plan and its Urbanizing Area Plan.
It's within walking distance of services. It provides the opportunity for connectivity of future roads. It meets the development lot standards, and it brings sewer to the area. It's within the urbanizing, or excuse me, the urban service boundaries. There's sufficient utility infrastructure in terms of sewer, water, gas, electric, to support the development.
Bree Hobb pointed out that with homes on only 52 of the parcel's 55 lots, the development will be less dense than current zoning allows. The approval came with some conditions. In a previous review of the plan on April 20th, area residents voiced concerns to the Plan Commission about water drainage, road width, and increased traffic. Conditions from county engineers and the highway department addressing drainage, bioretention areas, road design, and speed limits are all included in the plan approved on Tuesday night.
The Indiana Supreme Court has begun developing a new registry that will list all Hoosiers convicted of child neglect and other offenses involving minors. The new registry will be available to the public. Lawmakers say they hope it will prevent parents from unknowingly using child care providers with histories of abuse. State Senator Carlin Yoder of Middlebury was an author of the legislation, which passed earlier this year.
This registry came about because of an incident that took place in my home county, Elkhart County, up here in the north, where an individual dropped her child off at this home-based daycare and knew the individual that was watching the child. And in a tragic story, the child ended up dying. And actually, this woman goes on trial in October for the death of this child. But as it turns out, she had had a previous child abuse conviction in her past that nobody was aware of.
The legislation passed the Indiana House and Senate by unanimous votes in March. Governor Mike Pence signed the bill on March 21st. But Yoder said there has been some criticism of the registry.
You know, I had some pushback from individuals who have a felony in their past who said they've moved past it and so on. But you know what? My stance is if you're convicted of a felony child abuse, I don't have a lot of sympathy, frankly, and I want to know that if you're going to be watching my child.
Yoder went on to say he's not aware of any other states with similar registries. And although he says the child abuse registry will be useful, he noted that he is not aware of any studies suggesting a registry will reduce instances of child abuse.
I don't know if we have solid proof because it hasn't been established yet. I mean, it's not in operation yet. But what I do know is it's another tool for parents to use to ensure that their children are safe.
Similar kinds of registries have proven to be less effective than supporters hoped. Studies have shown that sex offender registries, for instance, do little to discourage sex crimes. A 2014 report from the John Jay College of Criminal Justice found that, quote, community notification statutes provide little, if any, benefit to reducing recidivism, first-time arrest for sexual crimes, or time between sex crimes, unquote. Instead, researchers have found registries often make it more difficult for offenders to reintegrate into society, potentially enhancing the likelihood of reoffending. The Indiana Supreme Court has until July of next year to make the new child abuse registry publicly available.
This month, Duke Energy, one of the largest electric power holding companies in the United States, reached a settlement with Indiana utility regulators to increase rates with the stated goal of modernizing its power grid. The 7-year plan to build, quote, a smarter energy infrastructure was submitted in March of 2015 as part of a plan to improve service to Hoosier homes, businesses, and industries. In a press release, Duke Energy stated the benefits of the plan include improved energy reliability and safety, fewer power outages as a result of technological advances, and more information for consumers. As a result of the agreement, consumers can expect a gradual increase, averaging 0.75% per year, between 2017 and 2022. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Carolyn Vandeweel.
And I'm Ryan Stacy. Steel manufacturers in Indiana want all Chinese steel imports blocked by the International Trade Commission to protect them from what they say are unfair and illegal trade practices. Correspondent Jared Dill brings us that story in today's WFHB Community Report.
Steel workers in northwestern Indiana are at the center of a trade dispute that could have wide-reaching impacts on the state's economy. U.S. Steel, a major employer in the region, is alleging that unfair practices by the Chinese government are endangering their business and violating international trade law. we spoke with Times of Northwest Indiana reporter Joseph Peet, who covers the steel industry in Lake and Porter counties. He says that despite declining employment numbers, the steel industry is still a major driver of the regional economy.
Yes, actually, Northwest Indiana, specifically Lake and Porter County, lead the nation in steel production. They have led the nation in steel production for the last 30 years. So when you're talking about American steel, you're basically talking about Indiana, because we make more of it than anywhere else. It remains a vital. The steel industry is spread somewhat across the state. A large steel company, Steel Dynamics, is based in Fort Wayne and with mills in the Northeast Indiana area. And then you have a couple mini mills in downstate in, I believe, Nucor has a plant in Crawfordsville, and you have a couple steel processing facilities in the Port of Indiana, Jefferson. So it's not confined strictly to Northwest Indiana. It is spread across the state, and it's a huge part of the economy here. It's still, like, the second largest employer. It continues to have more than 20,000 employees. It's the employment is a shadow of what it had been, due to the fact that beyond the imports and the toll they've taken on American manufacturing, there's also automation. They don't need people to shovel coke into blast furnaces anymore. It's just not as labor-intensive a job as it once was.
Some of these jobs can pay up to $90,000 a year and are a major source of tax revenue for the state of Indiana. U.S. Steel filed a complaint with the ITC after imported steel captured a record 29% of the American steel market last year. Currently, there is a massive overproduction of steel on the global market, which results in cheap steel being dumped in the U.S. because of its comparatively loose trade regulations. Pete explained that this in turn creates problems for domestic steel mills, which have high fixed costs like energy and labor that have to be paid regardless of whether they are selling enough steel to be profitable.
You can't just turn a blast furnace off and restart it unless it's planned maintenance. It has to be going at all times. And you have high labor costs. Those are fixed, so you have like a baseline where you're not profitable if it's less. And then the foreign competitors have, you know, illegal subsidies, and they have they're deliberately selling it here for less than what it costs to make, with the intention of gaining market share. And that's been going on for some time. There were more than 13,000 or 14,000 layoffs nationwide last year. Plants across the country were idled, including the tin mill here in East Chicago. And U.S. Steel, the U.S. Steel and all the other major steel makers, including the Fort Wayne-based Steel Dynamics, they have filed a series of trade cases. There are already, for instance, 42 tariffs against different types of Chinese steel, but they have continued to file trade cases against hot-rolled steel, against cold-rolled steel, basically just to offset the economic advantages they have by kind of cheating the rules. And they filed it in April in the hope of, it's kind of an extreme step. It hasn't been done in a while, but they're alleging trade secrets. China has taken U.S. trade secrets. There was a documented case from a few years ago. But then also the illicit subsidies and the they also allege they've been ducking tariffs by misrepresenting the country of origin. Like, they will send steel and not say, you know, say it's from South Korea or from, you know, somewhere else. And so that they've been ducking tariffs they're supposed to be paying. But they're basically trying to do whatever they can to stop kind of this onslaught of imports, which has been causing layoffs and losses in American jobs.
It is difficult to protect U.S. businesses by limiting Chinese imports because of the way the global market works. Chinese production has ripple effects that can circumvent trade rules. For example, overproduction of subsidized steel can result in China dumping that excess steel in Korea or Russia, which in turn leads those countries to dump their excess steel in the U.S. China produces a mind-boggling 70 million tons of steel per month. Pete also explained that the U.S. is not the only steel industry grappling with oversupply issues. Steel mills in the U.K. are hemorrhaging jobs, and some have shut down altogether, unable to sell enough steel to keep the furnaces running. domestic steelmakers have managed to score several victories this year in getting new tariffs levied against imported steel, including a 500% tariff on cold-rolled steel from China. Imports declined by a third after the new tariffs were implemented, and though some mills are still idle, those measures did improve stock prices for the industry and have curtailed some of the job losses. This year also saw a modest bump in American steel exports to Canada and Mexico, where many auto manufacturers have relocated to. U.S. Steel's filing in April with the International Trade Commission is seeking a lot more than just new tariffs. They want to see all Chinese steel blocked from import to the U.S. That would be a major departure from how trade complaints usually work.
Typically, there will be a flood of steel will come in. The steelmakers will argue for a tariff. That will raise the price, and then it'll kind of turn off the spigot, as it were. And, you know, they'll be on a level playing field with price. So they'll regain their market share. They won't have to deal with as many imports. But in this case, it could have almost been a play to Wall Street, because there were concerns about, you know, can U.S. Steel compete, you know, internationally. But they were, they're basically asking, given China's track record of, you know, giving its steelmakers heavy, heavy government subsidies, and then just kind of flagrantly violating trade rules by producing all the steel and unloading it, like they sell their steel often at a loss of, like, you know, $50 a ton everywhere. And you know if you're operating where you don't have the help of the government, you can't compete, you can't sell your product for less than what it's worth. They're asking for just all steel imports to be blocked, period, from various all the major Chinese steel makers basically. And it could potentially have a big impact. It would help preserve market share and jobs for local steelmakers. It wouldn't completely solve the problem, because then, you know, China would just unload it to other markets, South Korea, Russia, or whoever, Turkey, and then those markets would in turn, you know, sell their excess steel to the United States, unless those countries decided to cut capacity. But often governments don't like when steel mills close, because they have good-paying jobs. But it would at least protect the American steel industry from steel that is being sold for, that is often being dumped for less than it is worth.
This month, an administrative judge with the International Trade Commission delayed the investigation of U.S. Steel's complaints until next year. The judge said that the case must be passed to the Department of Commerce for review, because the complaint alleges violations of antitrust rules that fall under the Department of Commerce's jurisdiction. The Department of Commerce must now conduct their own investigation, which puts any potential rule changes off until after the presidential election in November. At that point, it is anyone's guess whether the new administration will be willing to take a hard line against steel imports. For the time being, Joseph Peet says that the region's steel industry is hanging on, even though its overall footprint continues to shrink.
They've seemed to have weathered the crisis. It was, it did result in more contraction, but they are still, it's still strong, it's still vital, it's still producing a significant amount of steel. It's still a major employer. It'll still be relevant. It's just its footprint continues to shrink and shrink over time. And people in Northwest Indiana, elected officials and planners, have been looking for, like, a post-steel era. Well, not post-steel, but they've been, you know, like Southworks in Chicago closed, and it's a park now. But, you know, they've been preparing for, you know, the worst type of catastrophes. But it seems strong and strong for the time being. This is probably the most economically advantageous place in the United States to make steel, because we can ship in the iron ore just over the Great Lakes from the Minnesota Iron Range, and it's very it's a very cost-effective place to run the big integrated mills. So it's not going to disappear anytime soon, but the footprint just seems to continue to shrink. ArcelorMittal has been closing finishing lines in East Chicago. It's unlikely that, you know, they'll be reopened in the near term. It's just the industry is continuing to have to adapt to, you know, changing conditions.
U.S. Steel has appealed the ITC judge's decision to delay the case. Special thanks to Joseph Pete at the Times of Northwestern Indiana for his help with this story and his ongoing coverage of the steel industry. For WFHB News, I'm Jared Dill.
You can hear that story and all of our WFHB community reports online at wfhb.org.
Support for WFHB comes from Monster Digital Marketing, offering digital marketing solutions for small businesses. Monster Digital Marketing websites are built for search engine optimization with both the desktop and the mobile device user in mind. Located at monsterdigitalmarketing.com or on the phone at 317-567-1197.
Up next is our weekly public opinion segment, Voices in the Street.
Welcome to Voices in the Street, WFHB's weekly public opinion feature. Voices in the Street provides an opportunity for people in our community to share their opinions and perspectives on the issues and events that matter most to Bloomington residents.
This week on Voices in the Street, Indiana's in the news. Mike Pence for U.S. Vice President. Last night, Indiana Governor Mike Pence introduced himself to the Republican National Convention as, quote, a Christian, a conservative, and a Republican, end quote. It took some time and deliberation for Donald Trump to finally decide on Pence as his running mate, but Pence now completes one of the most unorthodox presidential tickets the nation has ever seen. Having passed controversial state legislation concerning abortion and LGBT rights, Voices in the Street hit the streets to ask your friends and neighbors what they think of Mike Pence and his selection as Trump's running mate.
I think he's a man of principle. Unfortunately, his principles are wrong-headed and outdated, and even those he has sacrificed upon the altar of personal ambition.
What I just heard in passing, I think he's an interesting choice for Trump to make. I feel like Trump's strategy is to be as disliked as possible, and somehow that's working for him.
I find him to be an unpleasant individual who doesn't seem to share the same values as I consider decent people to share.
I kind of like that he's running for vice president because it means that he's going to give up his bid for Indiana, and I doubt that they're going to win, so go Hillary.
I personally don't know much about him, but I think he's like a brain-dead yuppie from hell.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like a very political move for him. From what I've been reading, he hasn't been too focused on kind of what's going on in Indiana and being more of a politician, I guess.
I guess I'm not really a huge fan of Mike Pence. I don't really know if I'm a big fan of his policies, like the RFRA or any of his other sort of under-the-table abortion restrictions and things like that. Pretty repressive. Sort of an attempt to appeal to more mainline ideological Republicans as opposed to the more populist wing that Trump seems to be harnessing.
In my opinion, I think anyone who respects Donald Trump and like is in support of everything that he wants to do for this country just has lost all my respect, and I don't think he will help this country at all.
I think he was terrible for Indiana, and I think he'll be even worse as a vice president of our country.
Mike Pence must go, and that's the best way I can sum that up. I haven't seen a politician this bad in quite a while. I think it's a perfect pairing in a horrible ideal sense, but in reality, I think it works in a horrible evil sense, but I kind of predicted this from the get-go. I actually thought Ted Cruz would have chosen Mike Pence also.
This has been Voices in the Street, WFHB's weekly public opinion segment, featuring candid commentary from your friends and neighbors on the issues and events that matter most to Bloomington residents. Voices in the Street is a volunteer-powered production of our News and Public Affairs Department here on WFHB 91.3 and 98.1 FM, community radio for South Central Indiana.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Kathy Norton and Joe Crawford, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week, a partnership with Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Jared Dill.
Voices in the Street was produced by Kelly Worley. Our engineer today is Chris Martin. Our theme music is provided by The Impossible Shapes. Executive producer is Joe Crawford. For WFHB, I'm Ryan Stacey.
And I'm Carolyn Vandeweel. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered independent daily news program.
Stay tuned for Blooming Out, Indiana's only LGBTQI public affairs show, coming up next on WFHB.
The Daily Local News is produced by a staff of over 50 volunteers
working in the WFHB News and Public Affairs Department.
Comments, suggestions, and story ideas
may be submitted directly to our news staff via email.
The address is news@wfhb.org.